Welcome back to the Mob Mentality Show. My name is Austin Chadwick, and as always, co-host is Chris Lucian. And I'm really excited to talk with Mike LaRocca today. We got some great topics queued up, including mobbing at a startup, balancing individual and mobbing and group time, and several other great things. So just really looking forward to this. So to get us started, Mike, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, totally. So I kind of had an interesting journey into coding, which involved working at a biotech startup. I got my degree in biochemistry, and they had a need for inventory management type stuff. And so my task was to kind of take their Excel spreadsheet and transition it into something more usable, and started doing research and kind of found out that there was this thing called SQL. And so I did some open course kind of stuff through Stanford and learned about database design and relational databases and SQL, and kind of transitioned their gene management platform into a SQL database, and wrote some stored procedures for kind of querying against inventory and designs, and outputting these little scripts that we could plug into a robot. And it blew my mind. I was like, oh my gosh, this is like super powerful stuff. The amount of time that it was taking somebody to do the same thing in Excel was like hours and hours, and I could do it in like seconds. And so that was kind of like the initial hook. And I was like, I want to know more. And so I started doing research on how I could surface this database to the rest of the company. They're asking me a bunch of questions about data. How can they answer their own questions? And so I started doing research into full stack, and I was like, oh great, this is a huge opportunity. I could learn how to become a full stack programmer and build an internal tool for this startup company. And so I pitched it, and the CEO was like, no. At that point, I was like, okay, I want to learn this. So I ended up going to a boot camp in downtown San Diego called Learn Academy. And I graduated there in June of 2018. So I've been out for 2 years. I did some time at Zito, currently at a company called Galley Solutions. And mobbing's been like a huge part of my career. I mean, did pair programming, at the boot camp. And that was kind of the philosophy. And then coming out, working for Zito, was a mob programming shop. And now Galley is a mob programming shop. And so I've been in it. So
very cool.
Yeah.
So were these experiences, so I guess tell us a little bit about what it is like mob programming at a startup. And it sounds like you've had, so this you might be the first guest that we have that has worked at two full-time mob programming environments, one after the other. I'd love to hear about both comparing and contrasting, and as well as what it was like to kind of initially get into mob programming and its effects on your skills over time, maybe.
Yeah, totally. I guess the last question that you asked is, it was really nice for me as sort of like an intro engineer going into Zito, which I was a little intimidated by the technologies. They were doing a lot of like Java microservices and things that I didn't have a lot of experience with. And so I was able to jump into a group and kind of get that knowledge transfer, where it was like, it was more of a safe space. It wasn't like, hey, here's an intro project, like go off on your lonesome and figure it out. Ask questions if you need to. Yeah. It was kind of like, I was doing, as we're coding a feature together in the mob, I'm like downloading their process of, oh, this is what the company's asking of them. How are they putting the pieces together, and just grilling them with questions, and I thought it was super helpful. So.
Nice. What was the, did you, while you were doing the boot camp, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that they might have also had some mob programming sort of content in their coursework, right? So, your entire, you know, or a majority of your training up into your career has been mob programming, which I also find.
Yeah, right. What's it like being an individual programmer?
Yeah. It's horrible. No.
Yeah.
What are the main observations, and I guess what are patterns and anti-patterns that you've observed for being in a mob from a more junior level and as you got more experience?
Yeah, I think one of the patterns that I've noticed, obviously we talked about like a quick knowledge transfer. Anything from bringing different specialties to the skill set, you know? You could have somebody who's more apt in front end work and more apt in back end, somebody who's a little bit more keen on testing, to kind of balance out the skill sets. Everybody kind of contributes their own little piece. Mm-hmm. So I would say that's huge. It also kind of shows that people can jump around from mob to mob. Like if you know the infrastructure, you can kind of go from one mob to another and assist them when they have infrastructure needs or something like that. So that's been a really cool pattern. I think a successful pattern that I've observed. As far as anti-patterns go, I mean, it's kind of tough to gather all the thoughts, you know, over 2 years. I probably should have meditated before this. And
no worries.
That's okay.
But I think sometimes it's difficult to balance out people's inherent, what's the word that I want to use? Like personality traits.
Yeah.
So if you have somebody that's like super keen on driving and being super vocal and really pushing the pace and showing the direction, that person can sometimes like overshadow and either take some learning away or drive the mob in a direction that somebody else was like, I don't think we should go down this way, but they weren't able to voice it. So it's really delicate communication boundary.
Nice. Is there anything that you either as an individual or the mobs you were in did to help kind of remedy that in any way?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's a couple techniques which are kind of mob standards, right? We have retros, which give people a chance to reflect on the, not only the project dynamic, but the emotional dynamic as well. Mm-hmm. You know, how are you feeling the last hour, 2 hours? Did you feel like you were, you know, not able to voice your opinion or blocked, or, you know, is there something happening there? So that's definitely a technique. We started experimenting with something recently that I'm kind of stoked on. And it's the idea of like roles within the mob. And so we don't necessarily, in my current mob that I'm in, we don't have like one person super good at front end, one person super good at back end. It's more of an even split kind of a skill set. But we found it was difficult for us to be able to care about and represent all these different skill sets at the highest level. So you have one person who's like trying to think about, are we testing the best and how does our syntax look? And another person's like, are we managing our checklist? And another person's, so we said, okay, we'll just create roles within the mob that people can kind of fill for a given amount of time. And then we'll reflect on, you know, how we perform those roles and that type of stuff. So
awesome. What are some example roles?
We came up with the first one is the taskmaster. So that person's kind of the manager of the checklist and kind of is the suggester of how best to split up the work.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we're all mobbing on a feature and, you know, the taskmaster's like, okay, we have 3 checklist items. And then number 4 is something that's we wrote down as kind of an unknown. So we'll you know, we'll knock out these three and then we'll split and do some research on this one and come back. And they're kind of like the organizer.
Cool.
Then there's the tester. So that person obviously is handling our end-to-end coverage and our unit test coverage and really like grilling us on whether we're skipping something. Or...
So they're more of like an accountability partner to the mob, right?
Exactly. Cool. Yeah.
I like that idea a lot. Yeah.
And one of the things that it grew out of was it's sometimes really hard to give critical feedback. And so when you have this role and, you know, it's a lot easier for somebody to hold you accountable to a role and you have that responsibility. So you have that self-accountability to a role. You know, obviously giving critical feedback is an art and accepting it is an art as well. But we found that it was a little bit of a cool technique to be able to have it land a little softer.
Sure. Yeah. Because you've actually explicitly outlined, I really do like this idea. You've explicitly outlined the person that's responsible for giving the feedback. So no one can be mad at them for giving the feedback because that's what you just asked them to do. Right.
Yeah.
It's very interesting and good in its simplicity for sure.
Go ahead, Chris. Yeah.
I'm done.
So, I mean, what's funny is I think we've talked about the devil advocate's role before on mobbing and different roles, but I think we've talked about a little bit before where I own the devil advocate role. I am the devil's advocate or I am the anti whatever person. And so it almost like diffused like this seemingly, you know, candid feedback. And so it makes it less personal and makes it more objective. Like, well, what would the tester say? Well, the tester would say, you're not covering lines 10 through 15, right? And it's not, don't look at me. It's just what the tester would say, right? You know?
and I really like it. Like if everybody is the devil's advocate for something, right? So it's like, hey, did we do the appropriate research? You're responsible for basically telling us when we could be doing better on research. And you're responsible for telling us when we could be better on testing and clean code. And so depending on the number of people that you have in the mob, you can really, be critical about certain things and not, like you said, not have the pain points. So I'm glad that we got through that series of questions. It's cool.
So the other thing too is that it gives that person who is the advocate the chance to grow in that area.
Yeah.
So they, like when their role is thinking about it, then they kind of are forced to dig into how do I gauge coverage? You know, how do I?
So I have another question kind of going down the path of the startup life. And so I think stereotypically, like startups typically have these, like, you know, maybe large crunch times or something where you know, panic mode ensues or whatever. What is it? Have you had any experiences like that? And what has the sort of crunch times done to mobbing or things along those lines? Was the mob resilient to that sort of stuff or not? Or, you know, how if you experienced stuff like that, how was it handled?
Yeah, that's a good question. So just to put some context onto where we started and kind of where we're, when we started mobbing and how long we've been mobbing is, we started with pair programming. So we were already kind of in the mindset of working together and collaboratively and stuff. And even when we were pairing, I would say the demeanor's always been, it's never been like a rush to get features out. It's been more of a, we, you know, develop things with high quality and we do it calmly and we make, you know, decisions like with an even keel head. And, you know, maybe you work a couple extra hours as a pair to try and push something out, but it's not like you need to have this by tomorrow. So that was like the culture from the beginning, which was really nice. And then in like January, we made kind of a big shift when we started mobbing. We hired a bunch of remote developers in Argentina. And we went from pair programming to mob programming with them. The San Diego team shifted to match the hours. So we run from 6 a.m. to 2 p.m.
Okay.
And they run from, like, depending on daylight savings, I think it's like 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. or 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. or something like
that. Interesting,
yeah. So when this whole COVID thing hit, you know, we were kind of in this remote mobbing sort of a mindset. But like, we did all that in a week or like 2 days. So yeah. It was a lot of, you know, what is our tool set as a remote team, and how do we, you know, communicate on Zoom and adapt to this whole new lifestyle? So we took a productivity hit for sure. But management was like super understanding. They were like, we're going down this road, you know, we're still producing features, but maybe not as high of an output as we would normally once we kind of hit stride. So I'd say it's been like a ramp up process, mm-hmm. where the expectations were that, you know, productivity was going to drop and things are okay. More so, I would say on a personal level, like, I have high expectations, so I have to check myself on, you know,
sure.
What we should be running faster, you know, we should be jumping higher. It's like the track and field background that I come from is like, how do you push the bar? You know?
Yeah.
So I'm like,
oh, that's where that phrase comes from, pushing the bar. Okay.
We're slowly teaching more, Chris, more and more sports analogies.
Yeah. I'm getting there one of these days.
Nice. Go ahead. Yeah.
Yeah, totally. So I'd be interested to hear. So like, what's that like in a larger company negotiating?
Well, you know, so a lot of it, there might be, you know, just external pressure in general. And, you know, depending on, you know, so a lot of it is about keeping an even keel, like you said, basically keeping keeping a level head. And so making decisions based on the right things, right metrics, whatever, you know, whatever they might be, rather than panic. I've seen panic destroy a lot of projects. And just, you know, decision making around the short term versus the long term and things along those lines that have really hurt and hindered. And so I was curious, you know, the reason I asked the question in the first place was because I've seen, you know, I think I've made a career out of resisting panic. And mobbing, I think, came out of that as well. You know, a lot of it, I would just say, yeah, I was just curious to hear about where, you know, when panic ensues from one place or another, then, you know, where does it come up, or how does it manifest itself, and is a mob in that environment resistant to it as well? And I think that just in general, mobs have a high level of resiliency to those sorts of things.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely easy to get caught up in the energy of other people and other things that are happening. And, you know, we're trying to land this big client, and it's like, you know, as a developer, they're like, oh, they need this feature. And you're like, oh, they need this feature. And,
yeah.
You know, you're trying to think about how to design it, and you can't even, you're not even in that mindset of proper design, right?
Yeah.
A lot of startups, like, you know, they write their initial, like, year code base. And then they start to scale a little bit, and then
it falls apart.
We have to rewrite the whole thing.
Yeah. I've heard that story a lot, where it's they write their whole thing, and then a year later they get funding, and then their whole team is just rewriting the same stuff that they did in the last like 3 years, basically.
Oh, yeah.
And that I've heard that story multiple times. Austin, do you have any more questions on the startup thing?
Absolutely. So, I mean, this whole topic fascinated me because it almost stereotypically seems like a walking contradiction, right? So, I mean, you know, like some people will be like, oh, mob programming in introverts doesn't make any sense, right? Or, you know, and I feel like there is this stigma with startup where you're going fast, you're going dirty, you know what I mean? You're just throwing features out there and everyone's working crazy hours, and it's this culture, right? And so, you know, startup and then mobbing together is just like, whoa. And so once you started talking about the culture, it was less surprising to me, right? Because the culture seemed to be, like you mentioned quality a few times. And I guess in this startup that you're talking about, this startup culture, it's not only thinking about the next couple months and how we're going to win these customers, it seems to be thinking longer term than that. I mean, can you explain a little bit more about the culture? Because usually, like, mob programming is like, oh, that makes sense when you have, you know, legacy apps that you need to maintain for 20 years and you need to make it really readable or whatever. But if you're going to throw it away in a couple months or maybe in a couple months, why do it? You know, so is there something in the culture that the philosophy to building quality in, even in a startup, is there anything going on in the culture in regards to that?
Yeah. Yeah. We make a product for chefs and kitchens. And the original version of the software was developed in a kitchen by the co-founder and former CTO, Benji. And so he got to be in the kitchen and around the chefs and learn how they, you know, work and do their process and write the software next to them. And they're really big on like mise en place and organization and sort of like structure. And Benji's really big on craftsmanship and sort of like the art of code, right? And so I think the calmness and organization and efficiency merged with the like craftsmanship of the code is like sort of where the design for the future comes from.
Nice.
And yeah. And then I think like, the products had a lot of, it's been well adopted or well received. And I think that there's a lot of support for it from like a customer standpoint and from like a funding standpoint. And so they're not like scrambling in the sense that like, we're gonna get shut down tomorrow. We need to do something amazing. It's more so like, we need to be consistent, keep doing what we're doing and build on top of it.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And one note on the craftsmanship piece. It's so funny. I heard it said recently in the past year, and it was really fascinating that the chef culture influenced the way the code was made in a way, because it was a programmer talking about a chef he was talking to, and the chef was like, he was asking, well, why do you keep your kitchen clean? And he's like, well, clean is fast. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. You know? And so startup, you need to be fast, right? And so what people usually think is clean is slow, but if you're organized and you're doing things well, you're able to operate fast. And it's just the second data point for me for the tie-in between chef craftsmanship and code craftsmanship. So that was really cool for me.
Oh, dude, it's the perfect, like, it's the perfect tech debt, you know, metaphor. Yeah. Is that if you're chopping and you're not throwing away and cleaning off your cutting board, eventually you can't cut anymore because there's no space. You've just accumulated all this trash. And so if you're not constantly like, so maybe I chop my pepper and then I clear the waste and I discard the good stuff, you know, I'm doing garbage cleanup and I'm working on tech debt as I build features. And yeah, it's cool. It's a nice metaphor.
Yeah. I actually, I think years ago I was in an art class in college, and the instructor was showing a video of essentially the like chefs cleaning as they go or something like that, clean as you go to, you know, to enable craftsmanship, things like that. So it was a sushi analogy, and I think it had to do with the Sakai knives or whatever, but it was also kind of, I've heard things like that even outside of the software industry, focusing on those things. So that's really cool.
Yeah, for sure. I would say that in the situations that, I mean, we all make decisions on both end, right?
Yeah.
So I would say the decisions that we've made that are snappy and more like, you know, we do need to get this done. We're having to go back and like touch on those things. So it's funny, you know, it's just beating back your, like you're saying, getting into a calm state, making a level-headed decision is just going to pay so much in dividends.
Nice.
Yeah.
So I think it's fair to say that not all startups have this, you know, wild, fast and dirty culture. So there are ones that do it with a more craftsmanship mindset. And that's fascinating to me. I've never heard of that before. So, so to transition topics, so you've been mobbing, you mobbed a couple of different places. And this is also a topic that I've been thinking about also as well is how do you balance individual time, mob time, group time, et cetera?
Great question. I mean, it's different, you know, per different organizations and different structures, and then also different like constraints that you put on yourself psychologically, right? I guess the most recent example is I'd been feeling a little bit like burnt out, or when I'd go to the mob, I kind of felt like hesitant and tired and just not excited to go mob with people. And so I brought it up, you know, and we kind of like discussed why. And it turns out that we were just doing 7 hours a day on Zoom mobbing the entire week. And I was like, I came to the realization, I was like, I've not had any personal time in my work life. Yeah. And so just taking a step back and saying, you know, I need a couple hours for research, and then experimenting with that, saying, where do I, you know, how do I plug this in? Where do I plug this in? What do I care about? What do I want to research? What do I want to learn? Like already I feel refreshed, you know, but yeah, it's tough. 'Cause it's like, it's almost like the unlimited vacation policy.
Yeah. Yeah. Where you don't take any vacation because you have unlimited vacations.
Right. You don't know. Like you have to really enforce it on a personal level.
Yes.
And it's like, there's never any, you need to mob for 7 hours a day, you know?
Yeah.
But it's almost nice to have that explicit, you have 3 weeks for vacation, or, you know, you have 2 hours. So giving myself that explicit goal of spending 2 hours of personal time doing something. Sometimes I just have to write those down and like put them on the wall.
Yeah, but, makes sense.
I mean, yeah, what's it like in your organization as far as like policies or, you know, culture, I guess, in that respect?
Yeah, well, Austin, maybe you can answer this a little bit and then I can chime in on higher level maybe.
Yeah, so from the mob or ground level perspective, it's kind of built into our culture that every day you have 1 hour of learning time. And then at the end of the week, you have 3 on a Friday. It was kind of built in. So when I joined this culture, it was just kind of the personal time was kind of there. And during that learning time, it doesn't have to be individual. Often we'll spend it together, especially when like on the Fridays when it's a longer stretch of learning time. But I just want to second what you said, and maybe it's a call to experiment or call to action for all the mobbers out there. Mm-hmm. If you're mobbing and you're feeling exhausted, you know, I think doing what Mike did is fantastic. Just to voice it, you know what I mean? Certain people, certain personality types need more individual time, need more rest time, and that's okay. You know what I mean? There are ways to balance it and figure it out. In recent mobbing, I have some people who are kind of more on that side of the personality pendulum, and they'll just, you know, when we're retroing, or they'll just bring it up like, look, I need some personal time, or I need to take a break, or I'm going to research this and then come back. And we're like, great, do it. You know? And so, so don't be afraid to raise it. 'Cause you know, mobbers are usually really good about, you know, being open to that and experimenting. Right. So,
I'll throw out there just to pile onto that is, I was in a retro recently, and it was kind of the topic of breaks. And so I spent some time in one mob where if everybody didn't take a break on a certain cadence, then everybody kind of felt guilty that they didn't want to take a break. And then I had the opposite in another mob where it was like, if you did take a break, you were guilty. And so I think in both cases, I let both teams know, it's like, hey, no one decision should feel bad in any direction. And so later on, the effect I think of that conversation had been that I'd seen the teams where you know, two people in a mob would keep working while others left. Or I personally liked the idea of actually rotating people out into a break. And so so basically one person at a time. So if you had four people, one person would be away for a while at any one time when the break time rolled around, but the mob would keep working even when those people left. I personally enjoyed that more than taking explicit breaks where everybody leaves at the same time. But I know that's just a small piece of it, but thinking consciously about the break structure is also important.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting technique. Because like not only are you shifting the not only are you saying we're gonna actually take breaks, but you're changing the group dynamic, right? Mm-hmm. Like certain people are going out, certain people are coming in, and there's like the shift in the energy and the people dynamics that would allow things to be a lot more fluid and changing, and that's pretty cool. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. And anything, I guess, kind of more from taking it up an even meta level higher, Chris, is there anything that both Mike or Chris you've seen that has helped instill a culture where people feel free to do that kind of thing, right?
I think that there's like, I've seen over the years just, you know, deeply ingrained culture. I think just software development community culture in general. I think this was much more prominent 10 years ago, but you know, the difference in my career between 10 years ago and now, I think, is that, I'm kind of isolated in an environment right now that doesn't have much of this evident. I know it still exists, but way back when it was very, the expectation was that people would be, you know, working crazy hours into the night and things like that when big deliverables were needed, or a CEO would make a promise that couldn't be kept, and then everybody had to kind of go into that death march style of stuff. I guess what I'm getting at is, like, culturally speaking, the burnout aspect of it was, you know, the conversation about burnout was much less tolerated, I think, in my career a long time ago. And so a lot of the retrospectives and a lot of the discussion about, you know, when is overtime appropriate, that has all been extremely valuable in recent years, to help shift and shape the way that those things go. But also keeping everything fluid has been really important as well, and making it something that a decision around that teams could make, given, you know, whatever company requirements were, has been also really useful.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's interesting. Like, I think on a simple level, like when you, so within the mob, you kind of have this like introvert extrovert dynamic. And I think the more you have an understanding of where you are at, obviously you get to know your group members over time and what their tendencies are. But if, like you're saying, if you're talking and you have that open dialogue, which I think kind of comes down from the top a little bit,
yeah.
It's, you know, do I feel like I have that open dialogue with my superiors? And then it's like, oh, okay, I feel like I can bring something up top. So I feel like I can bring it up to these guys, you know, or gals or whoever, you know, you're mobbing with, and, starting to develop a little bit more self-awareness around, hey, like, I'm in the middle ground. I love to be social and talk to people, but I also love my alone time. And if I get one of too much, I start to fizzle out. mm-hmm. And just keeping that little mental barometer on while you're interacting with people, I think over time can help you learn to know when to call things out or when to not call things out.
Cool.
Yeah, definitely. And I think it's kind of going into a coaching mode a little bit to be cognizant of looking for it in others. I recently heard of a scenario where there's kind of a clash of mobbing styles, so to speak. And then it completely exhausted some people, right? and so I think to verbalize those, if it's yourself, as soon as possible, we talked about, but also to look for it in other mobbers, right? yeah. You know, if it's break times, if it's you know, strict navigation or not, or whatever it is, to be looking, you know, camera on helps, looking at the body language, being vulnerable, sharing things yourself, and then hoping, inviting others to share as well. Because I think it's a bad situation when someone doesn't feel safe to say it, and then they just get burnt out, and then either they hold the feedback for a long time yeah. and then say it, or they never say it, right? And so to set the tone in your mob about, hey, it's okay to say if you're tired, it's okay to say you don't know, it's okay to all these things, it's okay. You know, we want to know so we can help each other and help the product, right? Yeah.
You brought up an interesting topic with camera on. Do you want to, can you dig into that a little bit?
Let's do it. Yeah.
So I hadn't really thought about it, right? But I used to, when I would go into the office, I have this external monitor that I can like plug in and set up. And I was pretty diligent about getting it up so that I had more screen real estate. But been at home more, I've kind of been more in this like modular, I'm going to sit on the couch for a couple hours, you know, set up my desk for a couple hours, stand for a couple hours. And I've been only using my laptop, which is this 13-inch MacBook Pro. And so I found that to code and have my test suite up, you know, if I'm the driver or the typist, I don't have room to have the faces of other people.
Yeah.
And that's like, I just realized that I'm losing out on so much feedback.
Yeah. And that's we definitely have situations with camera on, you know, so it's never in our groups, it's never required, but some people prefer it. And so, you know, I typically recommend people just model the behavior that they'd like to see. So leave your camera on if you want. And then, what did we call it? We called it like, communication fidelity back off. Austin, was that the right term for it?
Oh, bandwidth back off.
Bandwidth back off. Yeah. So it was basically like, if you can, you know, the recommended, I guess, path forward, at least in my mind, is, you know, camera on unless there's bandwidth problems, and then camera off, and then, you know, voice chat on unless there's voice problems, and then voice off, and then go to chat, and then, you know, so on and so forth. I guess eventually you're sending letters through the mail system, but
yeah, right.
so that's been kind of the bandwidth back off idea, is just like try and go to lower and lower fidelity of communication, but still communicate as much as possible. And so body language is extremely important. On my desk right now, I have three monitors. I have the camera right here. And that's been really good. And the three monitors really helps, because I can typically have the mob station, my own personal research, and then looking at the faces. And so this is very much like my everyday work. Another thing that people don't realize, I think, that's really important, is the actual when you're talking to somebody versus when you're coding. And so like right now I'm looking at my code and I'm turned away from the camera. And then when I go to speak to somebody, I can have the visual cue of like turning and looking at you. And that's also been really helpful, especially when people mirror the behavior and everyone's like that. We've been able to build a lot more empathy for, you know, levels of energy, for example. You can kind of tell when somebody's tired if they're on the camera. And a lot of time you can't if they're just muted all the time or something along those lines. And so, but typically you have to find people that are willing to do it.
That's great feedback. Great exploration right there. I'm already thinking about how sometimes I'll just talk into space, and you know, instead of like looking at the camera and saying, you know, so and so.
Yeah, that helps a lot. You know, we've done this a lot because we had somebody that was remote a long time ago, and all the mobbers were in the single room except for this one person who was remote. What eventually ended up happening is we had the camera on top of a separate monitor from a separate machine sitting in a chair, more or less, or on a stand, right? And it was off to the side where they would be sitting in the mob. And so it literally meant you had to turn your chair and look at them to talk.
We built the first Android bionic human that we could interact with.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Eventually we got his arms working.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw him in person, and I was like, "Oh, it's not just the floating head; it's the real, it's the real person." Right. Yeah, I mean, I camera on. I'm not great with physical body language, but I'm getting better, I think. And I think there's a big difference, right? Like, I'm like, "Hey, let's refactor, extract this to a class. How does that sound to you?" And it's a big difference between like, "Yeah, sounds good," and they're like giving the thumbs up, or like the, "Yeah, right," or
Yep.
Audio only, it sounds somewhat similar, right?
Yeah, and, you have no idea.
You have no idea if they're, and I've seen it sometimes, that they're like saying, "Yeah, yeah," but they're like, you know, holding, and they just look completely lost and confused, right? But
oh, yeah. I've done that like 5 or 6 times, I'm thinking now, you know? Gosh, it's so funny. And it's like a total reflection of your energy and where you're at. Maybe you're stuck on a really tough problem, you know? And like, if you were sitting in a desk next to somebody, you wouldn't be like, but it's because you're on your couch, you know, or you're in a comfortable home space of your remote land. So setting up an office, I think, might be a really important thing, because it sets aside the physical space in the home. But
also, I think, you know, on that note, I think a lot about this idea of, you know, when you walk through a doorway, there's this phenomenon, like you'll forget what you were thinking about when you walk through the doorway. And so I hear this a lot, but it's like, it's kind of used to describe, I forget what it's called, but I'll try and think of it. But it's a phenomenon of like, you walk through a doorway and then all of a sudden it's gone because you've transitioned spaces. I think the same is true for work and life and things like that. You know, as soon as I walk out my door, go downstairs and I'm with the family, I have a very different mindset, and I'm not kind of like in that work mindset anymore. It kind of all just fades into the background. And so using doorways as a transition mechanism is really an important thing. And there's a lot of like research around the side effects of walking through doorways that are very interesting.
Interesting. It sounds like physical space like activates a set of particular neurons in the brain.
Yeah.
Correlated with your store of data for that particular location. It's bizarre.
Yeah. I would wholeheartedly agree with that. I think this is a good segue into the idea of like tools and stuff, because we talked a little bit about mechanisms for remote. You know, we wanted to talk about kind of like tools for aiding in success. I particularly want to hear like what makes remote mobbing successful from your standpoint, like from a tooling standpoint, but if there are other either interpersonal tools or anything along those lines that you want to bring up too, that'd be great.
Yeah, for sure. Well, actually, you know, Austin and I had a chat before around tools, and he shared a few with me that idea boards has really stuck for retros and retrospectives. So I think what was great about that is that you sort of had this like this anonymous sticky that shows up in a column for everybody to see. And so it's this unadulterated feedback loop of like, you know, if you're doing your retro and it's like, you know, what can be improved, what went well, what can be improved, action items type of a thing, then, you know, you're kind of, like you're saying, you're unfiltered. And everybody gets to look at it and agree with it. Maybe you put something down that you were hesitant to put down and it gets like +3 or something.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, well, other people, that's great that other people are recognizing that. And so we do like a 10 or 15 minute at the end of the day, just like a brain dump on idea boards of all the things that we encountered. And that's been a huge tool for improving our retros. And we've switched it around, because it gives you that flexibility to create your own columns and do other things. So I think that's one of the cool things about that.
Yeah, I really like the, because, you know, the safety that it provides, you know. So if you're in a physical space and you're taking a sticky note and putting it up on a board, people are watching you walk up and put it on the board, and they immediately read it sometimes, right? And so you're like, oh, so-and-so put this up. And, you know, what does that mean?
Right.
Whatever somebody might be like a walk of shame for putting up something that they think is a hard piece of feedback to give, now, you know, doesn't exist, right? And so I've noticed that too. I think that you get a little bit more raw feedback on idea boards.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, we've leveraged it now in like, you know, meetings, like at a higher level. It's like, hey, we're about to talk to, you know, X third party service, you know, about their technology that we're using. Can everybody chime in on the idea board to get a sense of what we want to speak about in the meeting? And so it's been a really cool tool. Obviously Zoom, right?
Yeah.
couldn't do remote mobbing without Zoom. One of the things that I'm struggling with that I used to use a lot more is a whiteboard.
Yeah.
And I've heard about tools like Miro, and I've actually leveraged the Zoom whiteboard in the screen share, but I can't draw with the mouse.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So I've got a good recommendation for you. There is a system out there called VisGraph.
Okay.
And I learned about this from Llewellyn, and he was talking about adding this to approval tests for reverse engineering diagrams of infrastructure. And what was really cool about VisGraph is you're not drawing, you're just typing in nodes, and the computer draws it for you. And so I started using that, and I work on little video games from time to time, and I started doing all my storyline development through VisGraph. So what I do is basically say this key story point goes to this one. This one is related to this one, and it draws the whole thing out for you in a node-based mm-hmm. graph. And I also know that, for example, in AWS, if you're using Terraform, actually not even AWS, any cloud that Terraform supports, if you're using Terraform, they use VisGraph to reverse engineer all of your infrastructure for Amazon. So some really, really neat stuff, but I've been using VisGraph quite a bit lately, and it's been super fast for just making a picture out of a set of ideas. And so you kind of just do like, you make a little arrow out of a dash and a greater than symbol. And so you'll just be like A, and then dash greater than B, dash greater than C, and it'll make a drawing of a node that says A to B to C.
Oh, cool.
And it draws everything and manages the connections for you. You can label them, you can change colors and everything like that. So it's like completely keyboard drawing.
So. That is awesome. Yeah, that's something that I've definitely been looking for. We kind of have been using, Draw.io, right?
Yeah.
To do flowcharts.
Yes, Draw.io is what I was using before VisGraph. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. And I found that like I can move pretty fast with Draw.io, but it's like sometimes you want to be in that more free form, like just jotting down text or scribbling or doing something. So that's pretty cool. I'll have to check that out. Is it anything like one of those like graph-based note-taking tools? Have you heard of those?
No, I don't think I have. This is kind of the first one that I've seen like this. But VisGraph is open source and has a VS Code plugin too.
Cool.
But yeah, nice. It's low bar to entry.
Yeah, nice. I dig that.
Go ahead, Austin.
Yeah, and so you'll get different angles from me and Chris on this one, but no, VisGraph seems awesome, and that's cool for
that. I haven't sold Austin on it yet, but that's okay. I have time to work on it.
We'll see next episode where I'm at.
Yeah.
I guess for me, Draw.io is still what I use daily, just because I was slower at it first, and now I almost can like think in Draw.io. Mm-hmm. And I used to think whiteboard was better than anything at all, like being in person at a whiteboard. But now I think I'd almost prefer Draw.io because after I've gotten used to it, I can type faster than I can write. I can make icons that look way better than anything I can draw on a whiteboard, like search and drag and drop. And it's just way more free form, right? And so it goes wherever our minds are going as a mob, right? And so I think I've gotten fast enough with it where I can like think in it. Yep. And it doesn't have my terrible handwriting, and it's faster. So
interesting. Yeah, we should definitely, that's a good point to like turn to it for design more. Usually it's only like we open it when we're doing a big kind of like planning session or something, but it should be more like casual on call of a tool that.
And Draw.io or VisGraph, like the main thing is like draw right away. Like anytime you have a new idea, it's so important to draw. And every time I join a mob, the number of drawings that get produced, I think, goes pretty significantly up. And that's just because, yeah, it's just like, you know, hey, it seems like not everybody understands quite where we're going with this. Let's just draw it. Or it might not even be that. It's just draw it right away or help me understand by drawing it. Like any questions around drawing has been really effective in lobbying for me.
Yeah, it's almost hilarious looking back, reflecting on the last, like, even just week of mobbing, how much we would have been facilitated by drawing. Like, I've had these moments where we're all saying, like, probably the same thing in different ways and not understanding each other. Or something is just getting lost in the verbal space. Yeah. And you're trying to like connect the dots of somebody's maybe talking about some math or something. And you're like, what is this person saying? And then they're like, do you understand me? And I'm like, yeah, totally.
Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, the second you bridge that gap, the visual medium, it's like, oh, this is what you were talking about. Makes total sense. Let's do it.
Picture's worth a thousand words.
Yeah, there you go.
All right, I think we're hitting our time box. So before we close out, is there anything you'd like to plug or share, Mike?
Not too much, really. I do some blogging on Medium, but I don't know my handle off.
Link in the show notes.
yeah, I'll pass it forward, and that'll be in the show notes. I just appreciate you guys having me on for the chat, and it was a pleasure.
Yeah, this was a fascinating discussion. Thank you very much for being on the show.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, definitely.
Cool.
Well, please like and subscribe and share and give us feedback on Twitter, YouTube, etc. And thanks again for having Mike. This was fantastic. And we'll see everybody next time.
Thanks. Bye, everybody. Thank you.